we proceed to examine the case as presented by the pleadings. The words people of the United States and citizens are synonymous terms and mean the same thing. They both describe the political body who, according to our republican institutions, form the sovereignty and who hold the power and conduct the government through their representatives. They are what we familiarly call the sovereign people, and every citizen is one of this people and a constituent member of this sovereignty. The question before us is whether the class of persons described in the plea and abatement compose a portion of this people and are constituent members of this sovereignty. We think they are not, and that they are not included and were not intended to be included under the word citizens in the Constitution, and can therefore claim none of the rights and privileges which that instrument provides for and secures to citizens of the United States. On the contrary, they were at that time considered as a subordinate and inferior class of beings who had been subjugated by the dominant race, and whether emancipated or not, yet remained subject to their authority and had no rights or privileges but such as those who held the power and the government might choose to grant them. It is not the province of the court to decide upon the justice or injustice, the policy or impolicy of these laws. The decision of that question belonged to the political or lawmaking power, to those who formed the sovereignty and framed the Constitution. The duty of the court is to interpret the instrument they have framed with the best lights we can obtain on the subject and to administer it as we find it according to its true intent and meaning when it was adopted. In discussing this question, we must not confound the rights of citizenship which a state may confer within its own limits and the rights of citizenship as a member of the Union. It does not by any means follow, because he has all the rights and privileges of a citizen of a state, that he may be a citizen of the United States. He may have all of the rights and privileges of a citizen of a state and yet not be entitled to the rights and privileges of a citizen in any other state. For previous to the adoption of the Constitution of the United States, every state had the undoubted right to confer on whomsoever it pleased the character of citizen and to endow him with all its rights. But this character, of course, was confined to the boundaries of the state and gave him no rights or privileges in other states beyond those secured to him by the laws of nations and the comity of states. Nor have the several states surrendered the power of conferring these rights and privileges by adopting the Constitution of the United States. Each state may still confer them upon an alien or anyone it thinks proper, or upon any class or description of persons. Yet he would not be a citizen in the sense in which that word is used in the Constitution of the United States, nor entitled to sue as such in one of its courts, nor to the privileges and immunities of a citizen in the other states. The rights which he would acquire would be restricted to the state which gave him. The Constitution has conferred on Congress the right to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, and this right is evidently exclusive and has always been held by this court to be so. Consequently, no state since the adoption of the Constitution can, by naturalizing an alien, invest him with the rights and privileges secured to a citizen of a state under the federal government. Although, so far as the state alone was concerned, he would undoubtedly be entitled to the rights of a citizen and clothed with all the rights and immunities which the Constitution and the laws of the state attached to that character. It is very clear, therefore, that no state can, by any act or law of its own, passed since the adoption of the Constitution, introduce a new member into the political community created by the Constitution of the United States. It cannot make him a member of this community by making him a member of its own. And for the same reason, it cannot introduce any person or description of persons who were not intended to be embraced in this new political family which the Constitution brought into existence, but were intended to be excluded from it. The question then arises whether the provisions of the Constitution in relation to the personal rights and privileges to which the citizen of a state should be entitled embraced the Negro African race at that time in this country, or who might afterwards be imported, who had then or should afterwards be made free in any state, and to put it in the power of a single state to make him a citizen of the United States and endue him with the full rights of citizenship in every other state without their consent. Does the Constitution of the United States act upon him whenever he shall be made free under the laws of a state and raised there to the rank of a citizen, and immediately clothe him with all the privileges of a citizen in every other state and in its own courts? The court think the affirmative of these propositions cannot be maintained. And if it cannot, the plaintiff in error could not be a citizen of the state of Missouri within the meaning of the Constitution of the United States, and consequently was not entitled to sue in its courts. It is true, every person and every class and description of persons who were at the time of the adoption of the Constitution recognized as citizens in the several states became also citizens of this new political body, but none other. It was formed by them and for them and their posterity, but for no one else. And the personal rights and privileges guaranteed to citizens of this new sovereignty were intended to embrace those only who were then members of the several state communities, or who should afterwards, by birthright or otherwise, become members, according to the provisions of the Constitution and the principles on which it was founded. It was the union of those who were at that time members of distinct and separate political communities into one political family, whose power for certain specified purposes was to extend over the whole territory of the United States. And it gave to each citizen rights and privileges outside of his state, which he did not before possess, and placed him in every other state upon a perfect equality with its own citizens as to rights of person and rights of property. It made him a citizen of the United States. It becomes necessary, therefore, to determine who were citizens of the several states when the Constitution was adopted. And in order to do this, we must recur to the governments and institutions of the 13 colonies when they separated from Great Britain and formed new sovereignties and took their places in the family of independent nations. We must inquire who at that time were recognized as the people or citizens of a state, whose rights and liberties had been outraged by the English government, and who declared their independence and assumed the powers of government to defend their rights by force of arms. In the opinion of the court, the legislation and histories of the times, and the language used in the Declaration of Independence, show that neither the class of persons who had been imported as slaves nor their descendants, whether they had become free or not, were then acknowledged as a part of the people, nor intended to be included in the general words used in that memorable instrument. It is difficult at this day to realize the state of public opinion in relation to that unfortunate race, which prevailed in the civilized and enlightened portions of the world at the time of the Declaration of Independence and when the Constitution of the United States was framed and adopted. But the public history of every European nation displays it in a manner too plain to be mistaken. They had for more than a century before been regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit. He was bought and sold and treated as an ordinary article of merchandise and traffic whenever a profit could be made by it. This opinion was at that time fixed and universal in the civilized portion of the white race. It was regarded as an axiom in morals as well as in politics, which no one thought of disputing or supposed to be open to dispute, and men in every grade and position in society daily and habitually acted upon it in their private pursuits as well as in matters of public concern, without doubting for a moment the correctness of this opinion. And in no nation was this opinion more firmly fixed or more uniformly acted upon than by the English government and the English people. They not only seized them on the coast of Africa and sold them or held them in slavery for their own use, but they took them as ordinary articles of merchandise to every country where they could make a profit on them, and were far more extensively engaged in this commerce than any other nation in the world. The opinion thus entertained and acted upon in England was naturally impressed upon the colonies they founded on this side of the Atlantic. And accordingly, a Negro of the African race was regarded by them as an article of property and held and bought and sold as such in every one of the 13 colonies, which they united in the Declaration of Independence and afterwards formed the Constitution of the United States. The slaves were more or less numerous in the different colonies, as slave labor was found to be more or less profitable, but no one seems to have doubted the correctness of the prevailing opinion of the time. The legislation of the different colonies furnishes positive and indisputable proof of this fact. It would be tedious in this opinion to enumerate the various laws they passed upon this subject. It will be sufficient as a sample of the legislation which then generally prevailed throughout the British colonies to give the laws of two of them, one being still a large slaveholding state, and the other the first state in which slavery ceased to exist. The province of Maryland in 1717 passed a law declaring that if any free Negro or mulatto intermarry with any white woman, or if any white man shall intermarry with any Negro or mulatto woman, such Negro or mulatto shall become a slave during life, excepting mulattoes born of white women, who for such intermarriage shall only become servants for 7 years, to be disposed of as the justices of the county court where such marriage so happens shall think fit, to be applied by them towards the support of a public school within the said county. And any white man or white woman who shall intermarry as aforesaid with any Negro or mulatto, such white man or white woman shall become servants during the term of 7 years, and shall be disposed of by the justices as aforesaid, and be applied to the uses aforesaid. The other colonial law to which we refer was passed by Massachusetts in 1705. It is entitled, An Act for the Better Preventing of a Spurious and Mixed Issue, etc. And it provides that if any Negro or mulatto shall presume to smite or strike any person of the English or other Christian nation, such Negro or mulatto shall be severely whipped at the discretion of the justices before whom the offender shall be convicted. And that none of Her Majesty's English or Scottish subjects, nor of any other Christian nation within this province, shall contract matrimony with any Negro or mulatto, nor shall any person duly authorized to solemnize marriage presume to join any such in marriage on pain of forfeiting the sum of £50, one moiety thereof to Her Majesty, for and towards the support of the government within this province, and the other moiety to him or them that shall inform and sue for the same in any of Her Majesty's courts of record within the province by bill, plaint, or information. We give both of these laws in the words used by the respective legislative bodies because the language in which they are framed, as well as the provisions contained in them, show too plainly to be misunderstood the degraded condition of this unhappy race. They were still in force when the revolution began, and are a faithful index to the state of feeling towards the class of persons of whom they speak, and of the position they occupied throughout the 13 colonies in the eyes and thoughts of the men who framed the Declaration of Independence and established the state constitutions and governments. They show that a perpetual and impassable barrier was intended to be erected between the white race and the one which they had reduced to slavery, and governed as subjects with absolute and despotic power, and which they then looked upon as so far below them in the scale of created beings that intermarriages between white persons and Negroes or mulattoes were regarded as unnatural and immoral and punished as crimes, not only in the parties, but in the person who joined them in marriage. And no distinction in this respect was made between the free Negro or mulatto and the slave, but this stigma of the deepest degradation was fixed upon the whole race. We refer to these historical facts for the purpose of showing the fixed opinions concerning that race upon which the statesmen of that day spoke and acted. It is necessary to do this in order to determine whether the general terms used in the Constitution of the United States as to the rights of man and the rights of the people were intended to include them or to give to them or their posterity the benefit of any of its provisions.